Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome once again to Progressive News Network.
There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and
tell you
why.
Thank you all for joining us tonight.
We will beat them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Good evening once again. It's Progressive News Network, the show that brings you the progressive voices from across the state. Although we focus primarily on Florida activists, there are times when two wonderful things happen. Number one, we have a chance to talk to a progressive who's been working very hard, not just to protect human rights, human civic rights, but also to protect this fine state. We've got our first guest will be Greg Palast. We all know him as an investigative reporter, and he's just literally brought us a scoop, a tremendous chunk of information on what's the ongoing crisis in the Gulf of Mexico. We also have another unusual and special guest, Kristen Jacobs, who is a candidate for Congress, and she's on because her voice is a truly progressive voice, and she's going to tell us a little bit about her background and also some really useful information about what she brings to her hope to be soon new job in Congress. I want to play you a short interview that I took with someone who literally had the bravery, had the civic virtue to do some voters registration. We know how dangerous that can be in this benighted state of Florida. This is a short interview with Arlene at the Palm Beach Now conference.
My name is Arlene Houston, and I live in Delray Beach, Florida. Currently, I'm a graduate mentor to students seeking a master's degree from a college in Arizona, Prescott College.
Well, that's fantastic. So here we are at the NOW event in Palm Beach County. And as I understand it, you are helping register people to vote.
Yes, I am. I think every citizen in the United States should have their rights. I also wish they were more informed and took an active role, because that's what keeps the health of our democracy.
Do you mean to suggest that this is more important than, say, March Madness or the latest film records?
For me personally, yes, but I don't want to speak for other people's priorities.
Certainly.
I mean, family and other things come into play. But overarching that is the way we govern ourselves. And we have an amazing form, needs some fixing, but it depends on the input from every person.
That's right, participation of the voters. Why do you feel that so many legislators across the country are redefining and making more complex the voting process? I mean, you're with the League of Voters, as I understand, League of Women Voters?
No, I'm with the Organizing for America. Well,
okay.
I'm actually with that group, but we've got some permission from the Democratic Party to be nonpartisan and give people their right to vote. But the legislation, for example, if they don't get a form in within 48 hours, is a $500 fine. So there's a lot of obstacles blocking that path from you being a person to your right to vote.
Unfortunately, so many organizations have backed off registering people simply because of these onerous new rules.
And the fines.
And fines. And I want to thank you so much for doing what you're doing to help people register to vote and then ultimately hopefully be informed and cast an informed vote. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. My mantra is I'll do anything to give a person their option to vote.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it has come to that. They have made the mere fact of registration difficult. Now, why would they do that? They claim it's about making sure the rolls are kept accurately. But then again, they can't find fraud. They are, however, successfully making it harder to register. They're successfully intimidating a lot of organizations that used to register. But here Arlene is standing up for your right to vote, standing up so that she's going to make sure that more people can vote. It's a tremendous thing, and I wanted to get her voice on the air. I want to bring you some other news. It's been a very bad week for the people at BP who want to hide what's really going on, because there's been several reports have come out. Make sure you check it out. There has been a new studies. The people at the Surfrider Institute have been able to show that with using ultraviolet light, the Corexit stained oil actually leaches into human skin and cannot be scrubbed off. It can't be abraded off. It literally penetrates the skin. So make sure you check out the news from the Surfrider organization. And also, we'll have some more information on that same topic, I think, from our guest, Mr. Palast. So hopefully we'll be hearing from him pretty soon. He's a very busy man, and I'm really glad he had a chance to come and see us. So hopefully he'll be with us in just a few minutes. Also, some more news you should know about. Bernie Sanders brings to our attention the fact that the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant is the same model as the Fukushima plant in Japan, and despite that fact, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission chose to relicense Vermont Yankee just 1 week after the terrible Fukushima incident. Additionally, the Associated Press has reported the NRC and the nuclear industry have worked in tandem to weaken safety standards in order to keep aging nuclear reactors within tolerable standards. So to date, the NRC has granted 71 nuclear plant license renewals, and has never yet rejected one. Someone needs to remind the NRC that their job is safety, not a shilling for the nuclear industry. Also, on the chemical front, well, ladies and gentlemen, we've got our next guest, so I'm going to stop right there and bring on Mr. Palast. Good evening, sir. Welcome.
Glad to be with you.
We want to thank you so much for bringing your voice. You're doing so much good to get the real news out despite the corporate filters that are all over the place. Greg, want to welcome
you.
And I'd like to ask you just a couple personal questions, and then I'd like you to give us your take on what we need to know right now about either the BP breakout or anything else you'd like to tell us about. I want to ask you just a couple quick questions. Number one, you know, reading your first chapter, I learned that, you studied economics, that it was a very, your father's work in furniture retail had a strong impact on you. I was wondering, one of the questions I asked all my guests is, what took them from being just another consumer, you know, an appropriate shill for the corporate leaders of this country? What turned you into a person that had to make a difference? Could you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, in the first chapter, Vulture's Picnic, I talk about that. It's pure resentment against, you know, I just saw these rich kids who had it made. I mean, I'm just a little bit younger than George Bush, of all things. You know, my daddy couldn't make a call to get me out of the war in Vietnam. I got out, I lucked out on the lottery, on the death lottery, but, you know, and calls couldn't be made. If I got drunk, I wasn't going to get into Yale, et cetera. And good grades, and I didn't get in anyway, even with the top grades. So I was filled with resentment and hatred of the rich, something I thankfully have never overcome. And those who have special privileges in America and abuse them at our expense. And, you know, I have to tell you, and I'm not partisan about this, by the way. I don't care. You know, Romney, Obama, they all have their problems. But when it just reminded me, though, your question. When a kid, a high school kid, asked Mitt Romney, you know, I'm really worried about the cost of going to college. And Romney said to him, well, hey, you know, just go to a lesser school that's a little bit cheaper, that's good enough. And then he added, and don't expect the U.S. government to pay for it. This is a kid. This is a guy whose daddy paid for him to go to the fanciest private school in Michigan, whose daddy owned a car company, got him into and paid for Harvard. And do you think that he'd be at Bain Capital if he went to Ohio State? No, I don't think so. And because, you know, let's face it, whatever you might say, I mean, you know, I don't have a problem with Romney per se, but he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer. Either was Bush. You know, I mean, these guys didn't make it on their own steam. If it weren't all the, you know, if his name were Mitt Smith instead of Romney, you know, he'd be maybe a, you know, a junior manager at a car wash right now. And you know it, and I know it. The thing is, he doesn't know it, and that's evil. And so, I've had it with these guys.
Let me ask you the question about your formative years. Was it a fortuitous accident that you studied economics and then were able to use that so powerfully in your investigative reporting? Or did you have in mind to do that? Was that a premeditation, or was that just interesting synchronicity?
No, it was no. I was actually undercover when you. Anyone, by the way, get that first chapter, vulturespicnic.org, vulturespicnic.org.
An excellent read. Excellent.
First chapter. But if you get through the rest, you'll find that at the University of Chicago, I actually studied under Milton Friedman, of all people.
Right.
And, but I was sent there to study under him by the labor unions of Chicago, the left-wing labor unions, the big industrial unions like steel workers, auto workers, meat packers. When we had steel workers and auto workers and meat packers in Illinois, and they wanted me to get inside and find out what Friedman and these Chicago characters were up to. So that's why I was there. That's what pushed me to do it. Yeah.
It's obviously been excellent so that you could trace these multi-billion-dollar deals. It's been tremendous. So tell me, the work that you're doing right now, I mean, obviously your books show the whole range. I mean, you're truly a global investigator. What's the latest news, sir? What can you tell us?
Well, if you go to gregpalace.com, and a lot of this, by the way, is in Vulture's Picnic, but you go to gregpalace.com, you'll see a story about that before the Deepwater Horizon blowout. There was a prior blowout on a BP rig in the Caspian Sea, and BP covered it up. That is, and it blew out for the same reason. They used this cheap cement, what's called quick dry cement laced with nitrogen, which is not much used now because of the Deepwater Horizon. But they knew that this stuff could fail because it failed in the Caspian Sea 2 years earlier, and they covered it up. And my story is about that cover-up. I flew, when I got the tip about this blowout after the Deepwater Horizon, I flew to the Caspian Sea, to the nation of Azerbaijan. And there I was actually arrested while investigating BP, looking for witnesses. I found them, but they disappeared before I could film them. But I still got the evidence, because then later when I went through the WikiLeaks cables, I found out that our U.S. State Department had all the information from a secret meeting with the head of British Petroleum, Azerbaijan, and who said, yeah, we had this blowout and there was cement all over. And the reason why the State Department knew is that Chevron and Exxon were not getting their monthly royalty checks, because they owned a piece of that big platform in the Caspian Sea. And they were screaming. So they got their explanation, but everyone kept silent. BP kept silent, Chevron, Exxon, and the U.S. State Department, and the government of Azerbaijan. I've never heard of Azerbaijan. It's this Caspian Sea oil dictatorship. And basically was put in power, one of these nations that was created out of the Soviet Union.
Right.
Put in power by BP. And the government was put in power through a coup d'etat armed by BP, MI6, CIA, and this is, by the way, MI6 agents gave me this information, and they gave BP an exclusive drilling contract, so those guys were pretty well greased and taken care of, and so BP withheld all this, and if BP hadn't withheld this, those 11 guys would be alive on that rig today.
Let me ask you this. You know, we find ourselves with a non-responsive government, a government that doesn't notice millions of people in the streets protesting a war, a government that blinks and said, oh, everything's fine because BP said it's fine. After all, BP said nothing's leaking. These people didn't have an interest in prosecuting war criminals. Do you think there's much chance, do you think there's any chance that we can get them to prosecute BP for these lies?
Well, there is a minor chance. You asked me if there's a chance. A likelihood, that's a different matter. I think that the government is going to take so far there's an indication that the U.S. Justice Department is going to take some low-level people at BP and charge them with criminal concealment, but not of the big concealment, which was the BP blowout in the Caspian, and that was the very top guys were involved in that, including the paying of bribes, including the chairman of the board at the time, Lord Brown. These top guys knew all about the Caspian Sea blowout, and they hid it. That's a criminal act. I know that because I worked on criminal and racketeering investigations before I was an investigative reporter, and this is the type of stuff where we would, you know, arrest people for criminal concealment. It is, and also BP did tell the Securities Exchange Commission that they evacuated the rig in the Caspian, but they lied about the reason. They didn't say there was a blowout. So they lied to the Securities Exchange Commission, which is, you know, when you lie to stockholders, that's big. They lie to everyone else, doesn't matter. But that's a crime. So will the Obama administration take this on? I don't know. I do know that I'm working with Bobby Kennedy, who is professor of law, dean of environmental law at Pace University Law School. And he said, this is a crime. We're going to be sending a note, a message and a petition to Eric Holder, Attorney General. And now when Kennedy sends a petition to the Justice Department, because his own father had been Attorney General, they read it. So they won't have any excuse that they won't know the information. What I want to make sure is that once they have this, we will then see whether they act on it. Am I holding my breath? No, that'd be dangerous.
Let me ask you one other related question. Viewing in mind the number of whistleblowers that are being prosecuted right now by this once thought to be open government, do you see this as a dark shadow for investigative reporting in this country?
Terrible. Well, let's put it this way. I mean, in the end, the proof that there was a hidden blowout, and that this information could have saved lives. We only know that because of Private Bradley Manning, who released the so-called WikiLeaks cables. And he's in solitary confinement probably the rest of his life. Daniel Ellsberg was released because at the time they said, well, we don't have enough. Judge Sporkin, in that case, is America, does not have an official secrets act. If someone is not giving away secrets to the enemy but is publicizing wrongdoing, you can't put Daniel Ellsberg in jail for the Pentagon Papers. This is no different. This guy was releasing information of official misconduct. And again, in the case of Azerbaijan, we see it. In fact, he had information that could have saved lives if we would have acted on it. I am stunned and disappointed and horrified that the Obama administration, headed, as he points out, by a professor of constitutional law from my own school, would say that that a truth teller can be put in jail for the rest of his life. We have whistleblower protection laws, False Claims Act laws. Manning should not only not be in jail, he should be given substantial payment under Abraham Lincoln's False Claims Act because of his release of this vital information. I am horrified that the Pope of Hope has decided to act in a way that I think would shame George Bush or Dick Cheney.
I can't thank you enough, Mr. Palast, for joining us. If I can trouble you for one more question, one of our regular supporters has called in and has asked ask you a question. Lisa, go ahead.
Oh, hi, Rick. Thanks. Mr. Pilaf, it's such a pleasure to speak with you. I've been a fan for a while. I'm glad you're nonpartisan. We are too. The truth is like that, right? Got a few questions.
You have to be.
Yeah, you have to be. You can't be knee-jerk liberal or Republican. I'm concerned, of course, about the Deepwater Horizon. We're on the second anniversary now. I'm calling you from the Panhandle. I will not eat Gulf seafood, and I'm not alone. Why hasn't the blight of the fish getting more attention? I thought that Obama was not going to open drilling until the Woods Hole people and all the other scientists had done their impact studies to show the impact on the Gulf seafood.
Yes, I'm very disappointed. I join you in that concern. And I have to say that I spent a lot of time with the former chairman of the biology department at the University of Alaska, Rick Steiner. Mm-hmm. Steiner, because he's in Alaska, has studied the effect on fishing of oil spills. In fact, it hit him pretty hard because he, like a lot of, even though he's a professor of biology, he also owned a commercial fishing boat in Alaska and went bankrupt after the Exxon Valdez spill.
Mm-hmm.
He is saying that the science is still showing that there's a tremendous amount of toxicity and problems among among seafood and in the food chain right now in the Gulf of Mexico. And
oh,
the problem is that our government is not credible on this. We have to rely on the government to say that they are testing the fish, we are seeing the deformities in the brown shrimp population. We're seeing tremendous problems, and these problems I know from Alaska continue for years and years. It would be an extraordinary biological miracle if somehow the fish were was safe to feed to eat those fish especially shrimp. Within 2 years, shrimp are filter eaters,
mm-hmm.
and filter eaters are concentrators. So if there's a toxin, they concentrate it in their body. So I'm not the last thing I really want to do. The last is harm the seafood industry there. But you know what? I haven't met one of the seafood processors yet who is saying that they want to go out on a limb and say, please eat this stuff, no matter the effect on them. They care about people. These are really good people. And I think that it is all about the kind of drill, baby, drill panic that's going on in the administration and in the Republican Party. You have the fanatics, and in the administration you have the fearful. And the fanatics and the fearful have gotten together and decided that they're going to sell you poisoned seafood and keep drilling. I think, it's almost, we almost are working without a functioning government right now in terms of regulation of food safety. It's one of the few things we ask of government. And I think that we're being let down. I'm really glad you brought this up. I think that's... I got to go on because I'm still editing a new piece. If you go to gregpalace.com tomorrow, you'll see a new film on my what happened in the Caspian Sea, my arrest, and also I'll be breaking a story tomorrow. I'll give it to you on the massive bribery, the massive amount of payments made by BP to secure silence control of the Caspian Sea. And the complicity, of course, of Exxon, Chevron, all these guys work together. And if you go to gregpalace.com, you'll see the follow-up material and the films.
Good. Can I ask one very quick follow-on question?
You mentioned
that with BP, we're going to see a lot of low-level people thrown under the bus. Why is it that the American people, do you think, are so content with people like Lynn England after Abu Ghraib being prosecuted? Why are we happy when the lowly ones are thrown under the bus rather than the people who matter?
Well, it's the old sacrificial lamb. You got to throw the virgin in the volcano. You don't throw the hooker into the volcano. Not that I want anyone to go to the volcano.
You may try to rip her off.
Yeah, right. So it's always the innocent or the small fry. Some of the small fry, after all, are taking orders. There's no small level person at BP said, "Let's blow up the rig," that's going to take a chance. They're acting under pressure from the upper echelons, and that, of course, it is shameful. Shameful. And that's why Kennedy and I are going straight to Holder, because we can actually contact the Attorney General personally. And I want the Attorney General personally to say yes or no on prosecuting the big fish if I give him the material. And understand, I've done racketeering cases for the government. I'm not an amateur at this. I know what evidence should put people in jail, and we've got plenty.
Well, thank you so much.
More power to you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Mr.
Good luck with all.
Thanks for joining us.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And thank you, Lisa.
Bye-bye, Rick. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. And now we've got Miss Jacobs. Welcome.
Well, hello. Happy Earth Day.
Happy Earth Day to you, too. It's such a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. I'm excited to be on the show today.
Well, you know, you've got such a wonderful background. And before I let you tell us a little bit about that, and we do want to hear, because you've got just a marvelous background, I'd like to ask you the first question that I like to ask all my guests. And that is, what took you from being just another consumer, just another, you know, roll the ball along, make a little living, raise a little family, to a person who really had to make a difference, who takes the time, who puts in the energy to make a difference? Kristen, what was it for you?
Well, believe it or not, it was a stop sign in front of the elementary school. I was standing there with my son, who's now 27. He was a new kindergartner, and we were trying to cross at the crosswalk, and the school guard person was standing there with her stop sign up, and I had one child on my hip and the other one holding my hand, and my friend was holding her daughter by the hand when a car blew through the crosswalk without even stopping, with the person in the sign up, the whole thing. And if my friend had not been holding her daughter's hand to snatch her out of the path of the car, she would have been hit. And I was furious. And I had been asking for a stop sign there for quite some time, and with no luck. And after that, I decided something's got to be done. And I was unincorporated, so I didn't have a city. I had the county. So I went to the county engineers, and I tried to get a stop sign. You know, it took me 5 years. I finally didn't get a stop sign. I got speed humps in the neighborhood. That's where it all started. And what's interesting is my son is now 27. When he was 23, we finally were able to get that flashing yellow light was installed in front of that school, slow school zone.
Well, that's
how long it took.
That's a great story. Well, you know, it speaks to your perseverance. Too many times people, they just write it off because they think they can't make a difference. And it just does one's heart good to hear that people every day say, you know what, I'm not going to stand for it. I'm going to make a difference. I'm going to make this a better world. You've had a marvelous term of service in the Broward County government. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I know. I have been so blessed. I think it's been, sometimes I walk into the building and I slide my card through and the door opens and I have to stop and think to myself, this is so amazing. It's really me. There's still really great things going on and they continue and I get to be a part of it. It's just been absolutely wonderful. When I ran for the county in 1998, somebody asked me what my platform was. What was I going to run on? And I said, the environment, of course. And they said, you're crazy. That's not a big issue. That's not sexy enough. People aren't going to be interested in the environment. And I said, I think you're wrong. I think that people who live in Broward County are concerned about how we're growing and that we're not looking at how we link things together. It's not that I'm against growth. There are areas people have property rights. It's the way that we're growing. It's that we are not paying attention to transportation. We're not paying attention to what we're planting or where we're planting it, or the different rules that are guiding how we're growing. We could do this much, much better. And in fact, those are some of the things to this day that still have resonated most for me in office, and the things that I am most passionate about, which are issues associated with energy becoming sustainable and the issues of transportation. Why does everybody have to own a car? Why can't we create the kind of community where you don't necessarily have to have a car? And then above all, the environment, trying to do and make a community that's sustainable so that it's not just meeting the needs of us here today, but all of those still to come.
You know, I look at your information package, and I see a person who is working so hard in so many of the most critical areas of our society. I'm going to ask you about a couple different ones. Your Audubon Award. Can you talk a bit about that?
The interesting thing about being selected for the different awards is that there are so many different issues that you're all tackling at once, and then you are lucky to get singled out on one. The thing with being the Environmentalist of the Year was really exciting because there's so many different projects that I had under kind of going on at the same time, and so to be able to receive that award just meant a lot. One of the things that Audubon, of course, deals with is migratory birds and birds in and of themselves.
Sure.
And we happen to sit in a migratory path that takes birds not only through Broward County, but all the way up through the Northeast Corridor. In fact, mm-hmm. there's about three of these flight paths across our country, and we are right in the middle of one of them. And one of the things I always thought was interesting is that if you were a bird and you were flying through Broward County at any given place, you might be hard-pressed to find a meal and a place to lodge and to raise your young or to even get a drink of water. And so that's kind of where the Naturescape Broward program came together, which was to look at how we're using water, how much of the water we're using, what we're doing with it afterwards, and what are the kind of plant materials that we're putting in place that are driving some of our water use. Because we're averaging around, depends on the city, but between 50% and 60% of all our potable water is being used to irrigate landscaping. Couldn't we do this differently? Couldn't we marry the elements of the National Wildlife Federation with our needs for water, and water is turning more and more to be a huge issue for us, and marry this into a program that represented or looked at people, plants, and animals, that we all need to coexist, and of course that we're stronger when we allow these things to be in their healthiest state amongst all of these levels. So that was kind of the idea for the Naturescape Broward, was that when you got these issues right on your property, that you would be certified that you're using water responsibly, that you're using your energy responsibly, that you are putting the right kind of native plants in that will feed wildlife and birds in particular. And so as a part of this program, it was that once you had a sign or you were certified by the county as a Naturescape, then you would, in essence, become a little dot on our map. And our goal was that wherever you stood in the county, within a mile of that place would be another certified site. So if you were that bird migrating across Broward County, you would have these stops every quarter mile throughout the county. And we started the program 2001, and we started it with about 200 National Wildlife Certified properties in the county. Today, we're more than 3,000 certified properties, and we were the first countywide habitat in the United States.
Well, that's fantastic. So much of Florida's development issues hinge on water, water availability, water potability, and of course, water quality, and not just for humans, but for the animal life and sea life around us. There are so many stresses, so many strains on the water quality in Florida, from the development that had been allowed to just go crazy, to agricultural or landscaping runoff, to mercury from these processing plants. It's been an issue that's been ignored for far too long, so it's wonderful to hear that you were involved in that. And now to take a slightly tangential turn, an environmental quality of a different kind, could you talk a little bit about the work on the Community Coalition for a Living Wage?
Oops. You hear me?
Yeah, we got disconnected just for a second, but you're back. Did you hear my question?
Okay. Yes, I did, and I'm sorry, the line dropped off for just a moment. You were asking about the living wage. And
right. The
living wage, it is always surprising to me how expensive it is to live in Broward County. And to the degree to which you are working for our county either as an employee or as a contracted employee. Back then, as I started to look at some of the issues facing our workers, wages were a huge part of that. And so the idea of the living wage was that no one would work for the county and not have that work recognized, and that the amount that you would be earning per hour would be no less than 10% above the federal poverty line, which sounds like a pretty pathetic marker. And in fact, it's not the highest one out there. The national poverty line was actually a line to judge what it took to feed families by a home economist in the 1950s. It is still the barometer that the federal government uses today to decide things like who's eligible for food stamps. And they know that this marker, because it looks at no other real cost associated with living, it doesn't look at the cost of housing or energy or transportation. It solely looks at what it costs to feed a family. And because they know that that barometer is so inept and gauging what the actual costs to a family are. For example, for food stamps, the federal government takes 150% of that federal poverty line. So when I proposed that we go 10% above the federal poverty line, it didn't seem like a very big ask to me at the time. And Lord, Lord, I couldn't believe how controversial it became that we were actually going to set a living wage. And it was a huge debate. It passed the county commission with a 5-4 vote. It's been in place ever since. And it offers a wage that is associated with what it costs to live in this county, so that you're not for Broward County full-time 40 hours a week and then having to go stand in line to get food stamps. It applies to those who are county employees as well as those who contract with the county in 7 specific service categories. And what I think is most amazing about the fact that we passed this so long ago, in fact, at the time we passed it, we were mirroring the ordinance that was already in place in Miami-Dade, but we tied ours to an embassy so it adjusts each year with the cost of living, whereas Miami-Dade did not. What's amazing is that there are lots of companies who come to compete for work in Broward County who would not be subject to the living wage because they are not in those 7 specific categories. But I tell you, they walk in the door, and when they come in to tell me about their company, they know the question that's next out of my mouth is, what is your lowest paid employee earning? And so they come in with that information and compete on that information. And so what we have in Broward County is the outcome of that is that we are no longer taking this race to the bottom. How low can you pay people and they'll still show up to work, which creates a revolving door? Instead, we are paying people a decent wage, and they are not only coming to work but staying, in the longevity that's come about as a part of its passage has just been quite remarkable, and particularly in the paratransit sector, where you had some of the worst service happening, because whoever was driving for these different companies and learning the county, they were working for you today, but they were looking for a job to leave you tomorrow. And you had this revolving door of employees, and the service really was just not where it should have been. Once the living wage passed, however, those salaries are within range of what it takes to live here. And so you've seen that revolving door stop. And in paratransit, I think, is probably the best example of that loyalty factor where employees are staying put and the benefit that we've seen as a county government.
You know, I can't help but say this. And, you know, I'm afraid I'm going to have to compliment you once or twice during the evening. But I got to tell you, so many people think of environmentalists or people who are concerned about the environment as people who care more about plants and animals than they do about people. And what this says to me is your concern about the environment doesn't extend to just wild things, not just plants, not just birds, but it's concerned about the human environment as well, the wage environment, because, of course, that's as much a part of the ecology as anything else. So I want to congratulate you for being what I think of as a very well-rounded progressive activist.
Well, I thank you. And, I think of the environment isn't just the air and the water, although those are obviously important to our own sustainability. But it's the choices that you make every day, and it's the choices that government puts out there for you to make, or that you can choose from. So it's the choice that you made to get in your car or to take a bus. But can you make that choice? If the bus isn't going to get you where you need to go, then it's not fair for government to say, or anybody else to say, you're not making the most environmentally friendly choice, we have to put those opportunities out there. And so, I mean, there's a lot of really cool ways in which we can make those things happen. One of them is something I'm really excited in. That was in December. We launched the first ever countywide bicycle sharing program in Broward County.
Excellent.
It's a 4-city simultaneous launch, and it's built around the idea that you can find other ways to get around the community that may not necessarily involve your car. In fact, if you add a bicycle to the mix, getting from your home to the bus stop or to the train, if you have a bicycle available, might help you in making that choice. But you may not have the ability to put a bike on your car and drive it somewhere, or you may not own a bicycle at all. So the Bike Share program is this really fantastic program where you swipe a card, you become a member, or you can walk up to the kiosk and do it. But generally, swipe your card, you take the bike out, you take it wherever you want to go, you drop it off in a different kiosk, or you could go back to the one that you started from if you chose. And then you leave and you go about your day. We have them down by the water near the water taxis. We have them along the beach areas. We have them in downtown Fort Lauderdale. So if you manage to snag that coveted spot in the parking garage and you don't want to move your car, we would like you to leave your car there. And instead of clogging the downtown with more cars, borrow one of these bikes through the kiosk and go to lunch and come back. And so as a part of that, as a part of the environment, it isn't enough for us then to say, well, here's a bike, but let's make sure that these bikes are thinking about the environment in which you were leaving your office to go ride a bike. If you're a woman wearing a skirt, for example, you might like to know that our bicycles have skirt guards on them. Or if you're a guy with long pants, that they also have chain guards that keep them, the chain and all the mechanisms completely covered so that there's no chance that you'll get oil on your pants or get your pant leg caught up in the chain. The baskets are designed in such a way that they accommodate a lock as well as the things you might want to carry along. And it's been kind of fun to look at even the fashion industry in trying to encourage people to ride bikes all around the country. There are designers that are now coming out with clothes that accommodate bicycle use. And so we're now working on between the Convention and Visitors Bureau and the Broward County Transit Department, what an unlikely combination for them to be putting together a fashion show in working with the Gallery of Mall to look at clothes that will help, particularly for women, help them maybe make the choice to ride a bike to work.
Listen, before I let you go and talk about your candidacy plans, which I want to let you do, two things. Number one, I want to ask you about another area that is of tremendous concern given today's political environment. You have been a leader in women's rights and also in Planned Parenthood as well. So could you speak to that a little bit? We've all seen some of the shenanigans going on with the ALEC-driven legislation.
It's, you know, for women well, first of all, there are 62 million women of childbearing age right now. To have our bodies and the control of our bodies back before Congress and being questioned when we kind of thought that issue was resolved about 40 years ago is shocking that we're back to having those conversations today. It's not that American women, young women of today, took those rights for granted or the women who fought so hard for those rights to be in place for granted. It's that it's kind of like the air you breathe. It's the way it is. We don't have lynchings anymore either. We don't, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, why all of a sudden is this back before us? Do we truly have to pick up this mantle and run with it? And the answer, shockingly, is yes, we do. This issue is being challenged. Women's rights are being challenged. And we the ground that we thought we gained is all possibly at risk. So my involvement on these issues has, in the past, been very strong, very pro-choice woman. But to see that they are all before us again, this tells me that this is the time when young women, women of childbearing age, need to come together yet again to ensure that these rights are not lost going forward.
Well, I want to thank you so much for that. You know, you're a woman with an extraordinary past, a past you should be so very proud of. And before I let you talk about the future, I do want to mention one thing. We have a great group of progressive broadcasters who we all work together with, and I want to support them with just a quick mention. Gwen Holden Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters. Brian Stetton and his show, Progress Toward Democracy, Anita Stewart and her show of Wise Women, Amy Tidd, the Amy Tidd Show, and also Diane G. and her show, The Wild, Wild Left. So that being said, I want to thank also my co-producer, Mickey Royce. And now, Ms. Jacobs, could you talk about your candidacy and tell us what you see as the foremost issues facing Florida today?
Well, I think for South Florida, one of the biggest issues facing us are the issue, and particularly the district that I'm running in, District 22. That is generally, or specifically, a coastal region that runs from the airport in Fort Lauderdale along the 595 highway all the way north to Peanut Island. It hugs the coast and goes inland for several miles. But the issues facing this coastal district, of course, are the ocean and sea level rise, the loss of our freshwater wells to sea level rise and saltwater intrusion. The issues of water are of huge concern. The issues also and I spoke about it a little earlier that we didn't talk about, that I've been heavily engaged in addition to water issues and coastal issues, but the issues of energy and sustainability. I think that the American public is really sick of paying out the kind of monies that we are at the pump, and that our future needs to be more guided by our own energy and by our own sustainable policies. There is absolutely no reason why here in South Florida there isn't a solar armament on every single building, school, home. You go to other countries in Europe and you will see that they are using solar to a much greater degree. And it isn't just solar. It's wind. It's all kinds of technologies that would stave off the need to be drilling off of our coast, which I do not support. So looking at our own sustainability and our ability to control our destiny, I think, is inherently important for Americans and South Floridians in particular, and one of those issues that I hope to work on when I'm in Congress. The other issue is one of transportation. Right now, we have a community that is growing and growing. I chair Tri-Rail, the 3-county commuter line that's been running for the last 21 years. And we saw recently very many attempts by our state and our governor to try to take Tri-Rail apart. And luckily, in working with the State Department of Transportation, I was able, as the chair of Tri-Rail, to bring about some calling back of the guard and some settling down of the issues for the next 7 years that will keep Tri-Rail running. But we know that we need more and bigger dollars for public transportation and alternative forms of transportation as this region continues to grow. Cars are great. It's not that I'm anti-car, but I always think that everybody who's driving down the road may not want to get out of their car, but I'll bet you they wish the person in the car next to them would, so they would have a little more room on the roadway. And so finding those and building those systems are really important. And then, of course, you have the issues of our budget. We have a huge deficit in this country that is hurting the future. The young people who are working today are going to be inheriting these problems. And it's really important that we get up there and begin to talk to one another across party lines, across ideology. It is no longer appropriate to throw word bombs. I'm sick of it. I know the American public is sick of it. We need to start sending the kind of people up to Congress that will commit to work across all of these different lines to pull us in the same direction. South Florida's future depends on our ability to work together. And right now, Congress is simply not working together. This is at our own detriment if we can't take a new tack and decide that we're going to send a different kind of person to Washington, someone who's saying up front, I'm going to work with you and we're going to find solutions and we're going to have no excuses. We are going to find a way to make it work.
May I ask you a question about solar power? Solar, geothermal, alternative energy. It just seems to me that there is no reasonable excuse. So therefore, if there's no reasonable excuse, what do you think has been the big impediment to take the Sunshine State in a direction to take advantage of all that solar power?
Oh, there's so many little things that are in the way. So just to go through a couple of them. One of the first things is that you have a for-profit company, Florida Power and Light, and they are building and have built one of the largest solar arrays in the nation in the state of Florida. And it's great that this company is doing this. They have, and they will tell you, Greg, that they have the largest alternative forms of energy of any company in the country. And this is true. But the difference is that we need to be able to be generating, every home, every school, every business ought to be a generator of its own energy and be able to buy whatever excess that it or whatever additional energy that it can create on its own from the main grid. Instead, we have a different kind of system. And this is largely because we don't have something called feed-in tariff, as they do in many other countries. FTNL has largely resisted feed-in tariff, and it is one of the changes that needs to happen. It's one of the issues that the Public Service Commission, I think, has not weighed in as seriously or as strongly as it could, and it's something that should change. Another issue, though, is that we have the Department of Energy has identified one of the biggest barriers is that you have, for example, in Broward County, 31 different cities, all with different zoning departments, all at different levels of expertise, and that they are coming out to your property and they are having a conversation about whether or not you need solar, and they don't necessarily know because they weren't trained. So the Department of Energy actually put out a grant called the Sunshot Grant recently, and Broward County, along with almost every county in the state of Florida and across the country, participated in vying for that grant, and I'm really excited that we won the grant, and in fact, we're the only county in the southeast United States that did win the grant in this part of the country, and basically what it required was for us to go up and make some of the changes that the Department of Energy has identified as those roadblocks that are standing in the way, and that is just simply the zoning and the expertise of those who work in the city. So it is to create a model ordinance that would work not just for this county but for all the counties in Florida and states beyond. So we won the grant and we're busy working in that direction and really excited about the opportunities. And the third reason I think that when we talk about excuses and things that need to change, one of those is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And you may think, what do federally backed mortgage companies have to do with the issues of solar? Well, there's a program called PACE. It stands for Property Assessed Clean Energy. And basically what it does is it allows local governments to lend money to homeowners, businesses, and school districts to be able to improve by solar, by energy efficiency, changing out windows, and all the different things that you can do to make a home need less energy and actually create some of its own energy. But these systems are expensive. So it allows the homeowner or business owner to go out and build these, have them put onto their property, and then pay it off over a 20 or 30-year period of time, depending on the type of improvements that they've made. And it runs with the land. It runs as almost an assessment on your property. It is not a loan. But Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac put the brakes on. This was a program that was just catching fire nationwide, particularly on the west part of the country, when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac stepped in and said, whoa, hold on. You are now putting a loan in front of us. We are the first holder of a loan, and we will not be in second position. So this challenge put all of these programs at risk, and it has now been 3 years, and there has been absolutely no movement on it in the last 2 years. It's one of the things that I hope to work on when I'm in Congress, because those are federally backed loans, and there should be more guidance coming out of the federal government to free this issue up. In Sonoma County, California, for example, they pretty much thumbed their nose at what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were saying, and their program is amazing what they're doing out west. We should be doing the same thing here in Florida, and we're going to need to make some changes in Congress before that can happen.
Let me ask you one more environmental-related question. You know, so many of us are still concerned about the wreckage that British Petroleum left of the Gulf of Mexico and the impact it has on Florida from the panhandle around. Now, I understand you have some background in working in the Gulf as well.
Not so much the Gulf. The work that I've been doing in the last, my goodness, it's almost 2 years now, since the White House appointed me to the National Oceans Council, which was to look at all of the different issues affecting America's coastlines, the Great Lakes, and the U.S. territories. The Gulf Coast have, of course, unique issues associated with this bill. And Florida, as a part of the National Oceans Council, what the president was seeking to do was to begin to come up with some policies that address the myriad issues that all the different stakeholders have, whether it's those who make their living in fishing or those who are in tourism, whether it's your hotels or it's just marine-based uses. It's land-based uses that are affecting the health of our oceans. And then, of course, there's the whole long range of energy uses. And then, of course, there's the concern of the tribes that on all of these stakeholders kind of converging. And so the federal government divided our country into 9 regions. Florida sits in a really unique place. We belong to the southeast region, which is Georgia, North and South Carolina, as well as Florida. And then we also belong to the Gulf Coast states, the alliance. And so it's an interesting place for us to be in, because whatever happens in the Gulf has great potential to, of course, swing along into the southern end of our state and come along up the eastern side and go up. So we were very blessed in South Florida to have the currents go the way they did and not be able to pull all of that oil and that sludge back down around through the Keys and these incredibly sensitive ecosystems. We were spared, but there are over 3,800 platforms out there drilling for oil today. And while we were spared, we're not really sure what the future holds, not just for those that are out in the Gulf, but remember that the Chinese are now doing exploration for oil off of Cuba. And as anyone will tell you, the Chinese don't exactly have the best environmental record. So there are huge concerns about what's going off our coast. In fact, some of the exploration that they're doing could yield exploratory methods in the waters as close as 45 miles off of Florida shore.
Do you know, is there adequate funding to get a preliminary snapshot of water quality conditions in that region so that we can have a baseline against which to measure further impacts?
Sadly, right now, no, but it is one of the issues that we are working on with NOAA. In fact, I have a meeting coming up next week to discuss this very issue. Unfortunately, you have NOAA, you have Coast Guard, you have the Army Corps, all of which whose funding has been attacked. In fact, NOAA's funding, there was a bill in Congress just recently to tuck NOAA under the Department of Interior, which would further gut their funding. So we're in a precarious place as far as trying to baseline the conditions off our coast. Probably the deepest pockets to do this would be the Navy. And so we're engaging in some conversations there to try to understand whether and where we can find the dollars to bring personnel to work with NOVA and the county and the 4-county compact, which we didn't even get a chance to talk about, the 4 counties, Miami-Dade, Broward, Monroe, and Palm Beach County, coming together in a formal way, signing a compact to work together on issues affecting the South Florida region, and particularly in areas of sustainability. And our coastline is also a part of that conversation.
Well, you have to come back and talk about that sometime in the future.
I would love to. As you can tell, I've got my fingers in a lot of different projects.
There's a lot of things going on. You are truly an example to people. You're working in environment. You're working in the human environment. You're working transportation, water quality. It's amazing. I hope your talents and your skills and your vast experience is recognized by Florida's voters in a few short weeks. So I wish you every success in that arena. Do you want to make any final comment before the show is over?
Just that I'm really hoping that people are getting engaged and watching what's going on in this political race, that it is not just enough to vote in November, but to understand the primaries are the area where you start to weed out candidates, where you understand what their backgrounds are, and encourage people as the mud starts to sling and people get disgusted and turn away from the electoral process to resist that and instead to spend some time investigating all of the different candidates out there, whether it's your local water control district or your city, county, Congress, or a state seat. But really pay attention to who's running and pay attention to their background and their messaging so that we do have a good number of people turning out on August 14th. I think it's one of the most important elections that we have as a state. A lot of important decisions to be made on that day. And
Thank
the more
you.
Informed we are, the better off we'll be.
Thank you so much. I sure appreciate you coming by, and we'll have you back again soon, okay?
Thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, I want to thank you all once again for joining us. And I want to thank again my fellow broadcasters, Gwen Holden Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters, Amy Tidd, The Amy Tidd Show, Anita Stewart, Wise Women, Susan Nylon, The Susan Nylon Show, Diane G. of Wild Wild Left, Brian Stetton of Progress to Democracy, and also, of course, my co-producer, Mickey Royce, for all her hard work in putting these shows together. I couldn't do it without her. She is a gift and a joy, and those of you who know her know what she does in this wonderful world. So thanks a lot. I'm glad you could join us. Next week, we've got Patrick Murphy coming in, another candidate. And in fact, what's even better than a candidate is he's another true progressive candidate. So thanks a lot. We'll see you next week. And good night.